and she could walk without pain. Bryn, the mother of little Bethan, stitched a linen petticoat and took the time to embroider flowers on its edge, a fanciful touch beyond the ordinary clothing of the people. But no one scorned Bryn for it, for the girl seemed worthy of such a gift. Old Benedict carved her a comb which she carried in her pocket, and to the surprise of everyone, since he was fierce in his anger and solitude, lame Einar came in from the sheep meadow, hobbling on his two sticks, and gave her a hat he had woven her from straw. As spring came, children brought her early wildflowers in small wilting bouquets, and they helped her weave the stems into the straw of the hat's brim. She wore the brimmed hat to keep the sun from her eyes, but even so, needed to hold her hand there when she looked to see, because the light reflecting off the gray-white waves was blinding. She stood often on the shore with the wind blowing her hair and molding her skirt against her legs. She watched the horizon as if she waited. But she had no knowledge of what she waited for. The sea had drunk her memories away, leaving only her name. "How old do you be, Water Claire?" asked a half-grown freckle-faced boy named Sindri. He measured himself beside her, and she was the taller, but she shook her head, not knowing how to answer him. Alice was there. They were gathering herbs.
16 years or so, Alice said, telling Claire more than the boy,
and they knew Alice to be true in her guess, for it was she who tended the bodies of them all and knew the signs that each year brings.
16,
Water Claire repeated in her soft voice, and though she said no more, they knew that she was mourning the knowledge of the years that the sea had gulped away. She watched the little girls at play, laughing as they ran through the meadow, quick and colorful as butterflies. But there was sadness in the watching, for Claire's meadow days had been taken from her. They did not come back, even in dreams.
16, Tall Andrus repeated when he heard of it. The boy, Sindri, had told everyone, and most had shrugged. But Tall Andrus rubbed his hand across his thick blonde beard, looked across the marketplace to where Water Claire stood fingering ribbons at a stall, and said to his mates, "She could be wed." It was true that in this place there were often girls given as brides at that age. Even now the village was preparing for a wedding. Glynis, shy and sparkle-eyed, would soon wed horse-tender Martin, she not yet 17 and he barely 20. But old Benedict and Elise both said no, not this girl, not Water Claire. She must not wed, they said firmly, until the sea gave her back what it had stolen, until she knew what her life had once been. Tall Andrus, frowning with disappointment, asked brusquely, "What if it never do?"
"It will," old Benedict replied. "Bits and pieces, they'll come," Elise said, "over time."
Tall Andrus glowered. He had a fierce want for the girl.
"The sea pukes up dead fish," he said. "It won't give her back anything. What the sea coughs up smells of rot."
"You smell of sweat yourself, Andrus," Elise told him, laughing at his misery, "and should bathe if you want the girl to come close. Wash your hair and chew some mint. Maybe then she'll give you a smile some morning."
Tall Andrus stalked away, but she could see that he was headed to the freshwater pond beyond the thick trees at the edge of the village. Old Benedict, watching, shook his head and smiled.
"I told him she'll come back to herself. But truly, I don't know," he told Elise. "It's as if the sea sucked away her past and left her empty. What does she say to you?"
"She remembers only waking in my hut. Nothing before. Not even being in the sea."
They walked together along the rocky path bordering a wide meadow, each of them with a stick to lean on. Old Benedict was strong still, but bent. Elise, too, walked with her back hunched. They had been friends for more than 60 years. Elise carried the basket she used for gathering herbs. She was in need of raspberry leaf on this morning, to steep for tea to give Bryn. Since birthing Bethan 6 years before, Bryn had lost 3 babies and had fallen into despair.
Now she was again with child, and Elise would prepare the raspberry leaf infusion for her to drink 3 times a day. Sometimes it tightened and held a pregnancy.
"Is there no herb for memory?" old Benedict asked her, as she leaned to strip the raspberry leaves from the thick thorned bushes where they grew.
Elise chuckled. "Aye," she told him. "Try this." She reached to a nearby tree, peeled a tiny shred of bark, and placed it in his hand.
"Chew and think back."
Frowning, puzzled, old Benedict placed the shred on his own tongue.
"Think back on what?"
"On a time you choose far back."
She watched him. He closed his eyes and chewed.
"Bitter,"
he said, making a face. She laughed. After a moment he opened his eyes and spat the chewed bark from his tongue.
"I thought back to the day we danced," he told her with a wry smile.
"I was 13, she said. "You were the same. A long way back. Was the memory clear?"
He nodded.
"You had pink flowers in your hair," he said.
She nodded.
"Beech roses. It was midsummer."
"And bare feet?"
"Yours were bare, too. It was a warm day."
"Aye, the grass was warm and damp."
"Dew," he said. "It was early morning."
He looked at her for a moment.
"Why were we dancing?"
he asked, his brow furrowed.
"Mayhap you need to chew the bark again," she chuckled, "to remember why." "You tell me," he said.
Elise added the last of the raspberry leaves to her basket, straightened, took up her stick, and turned on the path.
"Back to the hut," she said. "My kettle's a-boil, and I must steep the leaves."
She began to walk away from him.
"Shall you take some of the bark for the girl, for Waterclare?" he asked.
She turned back to him and crinkled a smile at him.
"The bark does not," she said. "It's only the turning your mind to it, making your mind go back."
"She'll do that when she's ready," she added.
"I must go now. Bryn is in need of the tea."
He called after her as she walked away on the path.
"Elise, why were we dancing?"
"Take your mind there again," she called back. "You'll remember."
To herself, she murmured, shaking her head with amusement as her eyes twinkled at her own memory.
"Only 13. But we was barefoot and flower-strewn and foolish with first love."
Chapter 3.
Claire was there at the hut, with her coppery hair tied back by a ribbon and a cloth tied around her waist to protect her simple homemade skirt. She was chopping the long pale green stems of early onions fresh from the garden. Newly picked greens lay heaped on the table with a thick mutton bone near them, ready to add to the pot of water that was already simmering over the fire. When Elise entered, she smiled.
"I'm starting soup," the girl said.
"Aye, I see that."
Elise emptied her basket of raspberry leaves into a bowl.
"I'll just take some of the water first for my brew."
With a ladle, she slowly poured hot water from the pot over the leaves. Steam rose as the leaves began to steep and tint the liquid.
"For Bryn?"
The girl looked at the darkening tea.
"Aye, to lose another will surely make her heart sick."
Claire leaned toward the bowl. As Elise watched, she closed her eyes and breathed the steam. At her forehead, tendrils of hair curled from the moisture, framing her pale face. For a moment she stood there, motionless, breathing. Then she gasped, drew her head back, opened her eyes, and looked around with a puzzled gaze.
"I cannot,"
she began, then fell silent. Elise went to her and smoothed the damp hair.
"What is a child?" she asked.
"I thought..."
But the girl couldn't continue. Moving tentatively, she sat down in the nearby rocker and stared into the fire. Elise watched her for a moment. Then she went to the trunk against the wall. Unopened for years, it bore an iron clasp that was rusty and worn, but Elise's strong fingers pried it loose, and she raised the heavy, carved lid. Her father had made this trunk for her mother almost a century before, a bride gift when they were wed. It had come to Elise when her mother died. Her mother had stored things in it, linens and baby dresses, sprinkled with dried lavender blossoms. None of those things remained, though the scent of the lavender lingered. Elise used the trunk only for treasures, and there were few enough of those in her life. Now she reached through the things within and took from near the bottom a fragile bit of folded cloth. Holding it, she went to the rocker and said to the girl, "Watch now." Gently, she unfolded the cloth and showed her bits of torn brown shreds. "Smell," Elise told her, and held it to the girl's nose.
"Old," Claire said. "Sweet." She leaned back in the chair and sighed. "What is it?"
"Beach roses, from 60 years ago.
"Why?"
"To hold memories. Scents do that. When you smelled the tea."
"Yes." For a moment, something came back, the girl acknowledged. Like a bit of breeze, it drifted past. I couldn't keep it with me. I wanted...
But she couldn't say what she wanted. She sighed and shook her head.
"It went away."
"It's waiting," Elise said.
Carefully, she refolded the cloth around the dried petals and leaves and replaced the little packet in the carved trunk. Then, while Claire watched, she strained the dark tea and poured it carefully into small bottles, which she corked tightly.
"I'll take this now to Bryn," she said. "Add a raspberry leaf or two to the soup, and some of that sorrel from the garden. It'll give flavor," she added. "Those greens you have give bulk, but their taste is ordinary."
Claire nodded. Elise watched as the girl pushed the chopped onions into a neat pile with the side of her hand.
"Did you cook once, mayhap?" Elise asked.
The girl looked up. She frowned and furrowed her brow.
"I don't think so," she said finally.
"But something came back to you a minute ago," Elise said, "when you breathed the tea."
Claire stood, thinking. She closed her eyes. Then finally she looked up and shrugged. "It wasn't the tea," she said. "It came from something else, I think."
"You talk elegant," Elise said with a chuckle. "Probably somebody done your cooking for you once."
Claire took a deep breath, still thinking. Then she picked up the stirring spoon and turned toward the pot of simmering soup. "Well," she said, "those days are gone."
The three little girls, Bethan, Delwith, and Era, barefoot and grass-stained, smoothed and tidied the little corner of meadow that they called their tea place. A flat rock there became their table. They decorated it with blossoms from the clumps of wildflowers nearby. With a leafy branch acting as a broom, Era swept the ground around the rock.
"Sit down, dear ladies," she said. "Now that it's tidy here, we'll have tea."
It was a game they often played, serving imaginary tea to one another, pretending to be grown women.
"Your hair's a wee bit straggled, Miss Bethan," Era said haughtily as she set the broom aside. "Was you rushed? I'd expect you'd be more primped up and maybe brush some when you've got a tea invite."
Bethan giggled and pulled at her unruly curls.
"So sorry, Miss Era," she said. "This baby in my belly makes me forgetful."
Dramatically, she pulled her frock away from her own thin middle.
"Can I have a belly baby, too?" whispered Solemn-eyed Delwith.
"Yes, let's all."
Era tugged at her own skirt.
"Oh, I do hope mine is born soon because I'm so weary of being fat."
"Yes, fat is hard," Delwith agreed in a serious voice. "It makes you breathe all puffy."
"When do you expect yours?" she asked the others.
"Mine's coming tomorrow. I do hope for a boy. I'm going to name him."
She pondered briefly.
"Dylan," she decided.
"Tea?"
Delicately, she sipped from her own imaginary cup.
"Oops," Bethan announced. "Mine just be born. A little girl."
She cradled an invisible baby in her arms.
"Mine too,"
the other two girls announced. Rhythmically, they rocked their invisible infants.
"My mum be cross with me if she knowed we did this," Bethan confided. "She says it'd be bad luck to pretend about a baby."
Delwith stopped her rocking motion.
"Bad luck?"
Bethan nodded.
"Better we don't do it then," We can pretend tea, though.
Delwith smoothed her skirt.
Want a tea cake?
She offered the other girls each a twig. Era pretended to chew.
You be a fine cook, Miss Delwith, she said.
Delwith nodded solemnly.
I learnt it from the queen, she said, when I be to help her in her kitchen.
Claire, listening from where she stood in a small grove of trees nearby, smiled at the sweetness of the children. But their conversation troubled her as well, because it reminded her of what she had lost. It was more than the loss of memories. She had no knowledge. She wondered what a queen might be.
Had she known that once? Had she played this way once?
This baby in my belly makes me forgetful, one little girl had said.
Claire, working now with Elise, preparing the herbs for Bethan's mother, understood what the child was pretending. Why did it make Claire feel so unbearably sad?
She straightened her straw hat and walked slowly back to the hut with the herb she had been sent to find and gather. She resolved that she would learn. She would learn everything, about queens, whatever they were, and herbs and birds, and how the men farmed and what they thought, and the women, too, how they spent their hours, and what they talked about, what they dreamed, what they yearned for. It would be a start, Claire thought. Perhaps somehow she would learn her own lost life.
From a field higher up where he was prying weeds from the rocky soil with his hoe, Tall Andrus stopped his work, wiped sweat from his glistening forehead, and watched the mysterious girl walk along the path. She had favored one leg for some weeks, until the bruise and swelling disappeared. He had worried for her that she might become hunched and lame as people did when their wounds went unhealed. Andrus's own father, flung years before against rocks when a boat swung around and tipped, still held one arm locked into a curved and crooked shape. But he could see that Water Claire strode easily now along the path, her legs strong and equal, her feet sure in the soft leather sandal she wore. He watched her make her way easily to the turning. Then she disappeared into the woods, heading back to the hut she shared with Elise. A shadow crossed the ground in front of him, and Tall Andrus looked up and waved his arm at the crows that circled the field. His weeding was turning up bugs and worms, morsels that the crows wanted, he knew, and it put his seedlings at risk. He couldn't afford to lose the crops. Winter was long here, and in the good weather seasons they prepared for it, growing, catching, storing things away. His father was getting old, and his mother had been unwell for months, with fever that came and went. Tall Andrus was young, just 17, but the family depended on him. He would make a bird scarer, a mommet, he decided. Last summer that had helped, and he had a large gourd in the shed that he could use for a head, with a face carved on it, a fierce face. He twisted his own face, practicing, pushing his lips up against his nose, and then flapped his arms, the way the cloth of his mommet might flap in the wind to frighten away the crows. Then he stopped, feeling childish and foolish, and glad that the girl had not seen. For her, he wanted to seem a wise and hard-working man, worthy soon of a wife.
Chapter 4
They noticed that creatures frightened her. A chipmunk, tamed by the little girls, sat on Era's hand, nibbling at the seeds they gave to it. But Claire backed away with a startled look.
You never seen one before then, Water Claire, Bethan asked her. They not be harmful.
You can touch him,
Delwith suggested.
He don't mind.
But Claire shook her head no. She was fearful of the smallest of creatures. A mouse, scurrying across the floor of Elise's hut, almost caused her to faint, and fascinated in a worried sort of way with birds. She found frogs amusing but strange, and she was completely, utterly terrified of cows. Claire held her breath and looked away when she had to pass the place where a scrawny milk cow, its wrinkled mouth moving as it placidly chewed on the rough grass,
was fenced beside the cottage where Tall Andrus lived with his parents.
"I must try to learn creatures," she said to Elise apologetically. "It's not right to be so fearful. Even the smallest of the children feel at home with the creatures."
"Mayhaps you had a run-in with a creature once."
Elise was in the rocker knitting with gray wool in the dim, flickering light. Claire sighed.
"I don't know, but it's not a feeling of a bad memory. It's as if I have never seen them before."
"Fish neither?"
"Fish are familiar," Claire said slowly. "I think I have known a fish somehow. They don't frighten me. I like how silvery they look."
"Nary birds?"
Claire shook her head and shuddered.
"Their wings seem so unnatural. I can't get used to them. Even the littlest ones are strange to me."
Elise thought and rocked. Her wooden needles clicked in the gnarled hands. Finally, she said,
"Lame Einar has a way with birds. I'll have him catch us one for a pet."
"Pet?"
"A plaything. A pretty. He'll make a cage for it from twigs."
Claire cringed at the thought, but agreed. It would be a start to the learning. One afternoon, she stood barefoot on the beach, watching the trio of little girls. Using sticks, they had outlined a house and were furnishing it with debris they found in the sand.
"Here's my bed,"
Bethan announced and patted an armful of seaweed into a shape.
"And cups in the kitchen."
Ara set 5 scoop-shaped shells in a row. She lifted one daintily and pretended to drink from it. Delwith ran to fetch a branch she saw beside some rocks and dragged it back. Torn from a nearby tree by the constant wind, it was crowned with a thicket of leaves.
"Broom, I found us a broom,"
the little girl announced happily, and scraped the sand with it.
"Wait, it needs fixing."
Carefully, she tugged at a thin side branch, broke it loose, and tossed it aside.
"There, now it's a proper broom."
Claire, watching, leaned down and picked up the slender branch that Delwith had discarded. The sand was damp, and she saw her own footprints in it. With the tip of the branch, she poked a round hole in each of her own toe prints, then laughed and scribbled the footprints away with the stick. A gentle surge of seawater moved in silently, smoothed the roughened sand, and receded. She leaned forward and wrote the first letter of her name. C, then L, and A. But a foamy inrush of seawater erased the letters. Claire moved back slightly, farther from the sea's edge, and began again.
C-L-A-I-R-E, she wrote.
"What be that?"
A shadow fell across her letters. It was Bethan looking down.
"My name."
The little girl stared at it.
"Would you like to do your name beside it?"
Claire offered her the stick.
"How?"
she asked.
"Just make the letters."
"What be letters?"
Claire was startled at first. Then she thought, oh, they haven't learned yet. She had a sudden image of herself learning, of a teacher explaining the sounds of letters. There was a place she had gone, a place called school. All children did. But she looked around now at the cliff and hills and huts at the sea. She could see the boats bobbing in the distance and the men leaning in with their nets. And she was uncertain.
"Will you go to school soon?" she asked Bethan.
"What be school?"
She didn't know how to answer the child, and maybe she realized it wasn't important. 6 letters. They made a name. What did it matter? She looked again at the word she had written, then erased it with her own toes, stamped the sand firm, and tossed the stick into a pile of glistening kelp nearby. Elise had sent old Benedict to ask the favor of lame Einar. Not long after, slow on his ruined feet, the young man made his way laboriously down from his hut on the hillside, carrying the twig cage on his back with the bird inside.
"Here it be," he told Elise.
Einar was not one for talking. His failures had made him a recluse, but people remembered the vulnerable boy he had once been. Though he had stolen from his father, they forgave him that. His father had been a harsh and unjust man. That he had climbed out, many admired, for the cliff was steep and jagged, and the world beyond unknown. Few had the courage that Einar had had. They regretted his failure, but they welcomed his damaged return. Einar, though, had never forgiven himself. He lived in self-imposed shame and stayed mostly silent. "It sings," he said. He leaned his two sturdy sticks against Elise's hut and hung the cage on a tree branch near the entrance. He watched for a moment until the carefully crafted perch inside stopped swaying, and the little finch stilled the nervous flutter of its bright colored wings. Then lame Einar took up his sticks again. He righted himself between them for balance and went slowly away. The bird was chirping when Claire returned from the beach carrying her sandals. She stopped in surprise, looking at the cage and the bird within.
"It can't get out, can it?" she asked nervously.
Elise laughed.
"Were you to take it in your hand, child, it would tremble in fear. Have you never been near to a wee bird before?"
Claire shook her head, no.
"You'll feed it each day, seeds mostly, and some of the bugs from the field."
"I don't like the bugs," Claire whispered.
"It will help when you learn them. Fear dims when you learn things."
The bird chirped loudly, and Claire jumped. Elise laughed at her again. Claire took a breath and calmed herself. She went closer and peered into the cage. The bird tilted its head and looked back at her.
"It should have a name," Claire said.
"Name it, then. It be yours."
"I've never named a single thing."
Elise frowned, and she looked at Claire with her squinted eyes.
"Do you know that, then?" she asked.
Claire sighed. "I feel it, that's all."
"Naming is hard. Someone named you once."
Claire looked away.
"I suppose," she said slowly,
and then turned her attention again to the cage.
"Look, it cleans itself,"
she pointed. The bird had raised one wing and pecked fastidiously at its feathers beneath.
"Isn't that a lovely patch of color on his wing?"
She hesitated, then asked,
"What is it called?"
"I know red.
You taught me red from the berries. It's a pretty red there around his eyes. But what is that bright color on his wing? I can't think of its name."
Elise was troubled by this, for she knew by now that the girl was clever and filled with knowledge of many things, but she seemed lacking in so many ways, and the realm of colors was one. The names of the various hues were one of the first things small children learned. Yet when Elise had sent Claire on a simple errand some days ago, asking her to fetch some jewelweed, which Elise needed to treat a painful poison ivy rash on one of old Benedict's grandsons, Claire had not known how to find the flower that grew in such profusion by the stream.
"The bright orange blossoms," Elise reminded her. "We gathered some the other day."
"I forget orange," Claire had said, embarrassed.
"We gathered several things that day. What does orange look like?"
And now she could not name the color that decorated the wing of the little singing finch.
"Yellow," Elise told her. "The same as evening primrose. Remember?"
"Yellow,"
Claire repeated it, learning it. Yellow Wing became the bird's name. On a cool, foggy morning, she climbed the hill to find lame Einar and thank him. It had taken a while to accustom herself to the bird, to end her fearfulness around it, but now it hopped to the side of the cage when she brought seeds to it in a little shell dish and waited, head cocked, while she set the dish down. It would have hopped onto her finger, she knew, if she had held it still and waited, but she wasn't ready for that, or for the feeding of live insects. The little girls took on that task, happily to find beetles and hoppers in the grass and bring them to Yellow Wing. She found Einar near his hut. He was seated on a flat rock, cleaning a wooden bowl, scrubbing the cracks in the rounded poplar with a rag dipped in fire ash. Nearby, through the fog, she could hear the sheep move in the grass, and an occasional bleat. She approached the young man. She was nervous. Not to be with Einar, who was always silent and unknowable, but because of the sounds of the animals. He was startled to see her, and lowered his eyes to the bowl.
Had he heard her coming, he would have fled into the fog and disappeared. But Claire had been silent, appearing without warning from the swirling gray mist, and his maimed feet made it impossible for him to jump and run.
"Good morning," she said, and he nodded in reply. "I came to thank you for the bird," she told him.
"It's naught but a bird," he muttered.
Claire stared at him for a moment. A word came to her from nowhere. "He's lonely," she thought. "People say he's angry and hermit-like, but it's loneliness that afflicts him." She looked around and saw a log nearby.
"May I sit down?" she asked politely.
He grunted in assent and scraped some more at the spotless bowl in his hands.
"I know it's just a bird," she told him. "But you see, I have been afraid of birds. They're strange to me. I don't know why. And so the little bird you brought me, I call him Yellowwing." She saw his puzzled look and laughed. "I know, it's just his color, but I'm only learning colors. They're as strange to me as birds, and so it's a help to call him Yellowwing. I say his name when I put his dish of seeds in the cage. And you know what? He's singing now. He was afraid at first, but now he sings."
Einar looked at her. Then he arranged his mouth, gave a small sound as a trial, and then reproduced the sound of the small bright-colored bird with its trill and fluttering whistle.
Claire listened in delight. "Could you do the songs of other birds?" she asked him.
But he ducked his head in embarrassment and didn't reply. He set the bowl aside and reached for his sticks.
"Sheep need me," he said brusquely.
He rose and moved with his awkward gait into the edge of the foggy meadow. He was no more than a blurred outline when she heard him call back to her.
"Greens," he called. "Not the color, but he needs greens. Willow buds be good and dandelion." Then he was gone.
But as she gathered herself to leave, she heard him whistle the song of the bird once again.
Elise and old Benedict stood watching the preparations for the marriage of Glennis and Martin. Friends of the couple had built a kind of bower from supple willow branches, and now they were decorating it with blossoms and ferns. Beyond, on tables made of board and set outside for the occasion, the women were arranging food and drink.
"It's a fine day," Elise commented, squinting at the cloudless sky. "I was wed in rain," old Benedict said with a chuckle, "and never noticed a drop of it."
She smiled at him.
"I remember your wedding day," she said, "and Eilish, all smiles. You must miss her, Ben."
He nodded. His wife of many years had died from a sudden fever the winter before, with their children and grandchildren watching in sorrow. She was buried now in the village graveyard, with a small stone marker marking her place, and room beside her for old Benedict when his time came.
"Look there, at tall Andrus watching the girl," old Benedict said with a chuckle and pointed. "He's bent near double with longing for her, isn't it so?"
They both watched with amusement as the young man's lovesick gaze followed Claire, who was helping with the flowers. She hardly noticed him.
"She puzzles me, Benedict."
"Aye, she's a mystery, but a splendid one."
While they watched her, Claire lifted one of the little girls and helped her weave daisies into the twigs of the bower. The other little ones waited eagerly for their turns.
"They follow her like kittens after the mother cat, don't they?"
"Do you know she fears cats? Even kittens? As if she'd never seen such before," Elise told him.
"And birds, I hear. Lame Einar caught a bird for her and wove a cage for it. She's learning to like it now, for it sings nicely. But Ben..."
"Aye?" "I had to tell her the colors of it. She don't know the names. Yellow and red. It's as if they are new to her, and yet she's clever, clever as can be. She creates games for the little girls and helps me with the herbs, but..."
"I never knowed one who couldn't say the colors. Not even one who is weak in the mind like Eilish's nephew, who's like a young boy, though he's 30. Even he cries for his blue shirt instead of the green," old Benedict said.
"Not water, Claire. She may long for the blue, but don't know its name.
She's learning now, but she's like a babe about it. So you've got you a wee babe to tend after all these years without, he teased her.
He patted her hip through the thick skirt and she pushed his hand away.
Let me be, you old fool, she told him fondly.
Chapter 5
Tell me about weddings, Claire asked as she and Elise carried the nut cake they had made to the feast table, where it would be placed with the festive puddings and sweets. Does everyone have one? Did you?
Elise laughed.
Not me, she said. But most do when they reach an age as Martin and Glennis. When they choose each other and the parents say aye, then we have the hand fasting. Always in summer. Usually at new moon.
Summer, Claire had learned already from Elise, that summer is a time of year, the time of sunshine and crops and the birth of young animals. It had been one more thing she had not known. She waited while Elise rearranged some of the other foods in order to make room. Then she set down their cake and together they decorated its edge with yellow daisies. The village people were gathering. Not one, not even the fishermen, was at work today. Babies perched atop their father's shoulders. Claire saw tall Andrus with his parents, the three of them scrubbed and dressed in their best clothing. She could see that his mother was not well. She leaned on her son and was flushed with fever, though she smiled and greeted the others. Bryn waved to Claire. She was holding Bethan's hand. For once, the three little girls were separate, each with their families. Claire could see that beneath her lace-trimmed apron, Bryn's body had thickened with the coming child. Elise thought the time of danger was past and that this one would survive.
Oh, what's that? Claire asked, startled at a sound.
From the path, several young village men approached and the crowd opened to make way for them. One was blowing into a carved flute. Another kept time on a small drum made from an animal skin stretched across a hollowed gourd. The third plucked at strings stretched across a long-necked instrument made of wood. Moving in time with the melody, they entered the circle that had opened to admit them as Claire watched from where she and Elise stood at the edge.
It's so lovely. Listen, how they make the sounds go together. I've never heard anything like that before.
Elise frowned.
It's music, child. Have you never heard music? Have you forgotten it?
No, never, Claire whispered. I'm quite sure.
The hand-fasting ceremony ended as Martin and Glennis kissed each other, and the red ribbon that had been wound around them unfurled, loosened, and freed them. The musicians began again with a louder, rollicking tune, and the villagers cheered and turned to the waiting feast. Claire stood silent, awed by the music, puzzled by the concept of love, and moved by both the solemnity and the celebration of the occasion. When she turned to look through the noisy, laughing throng for Elise, she suddenly noticed lame Einar, standing alone on a small rise at the edge of the meadow. While she watched, he adjusted the two sticks that supported him, turned, and hobbled slowly away. For a moment she thought of running over to invite him back, to entice him to join in. But her attention was drawn by the music. Never had she heard such an enticing thing as music, she was sure of it. And now the villagers were choosing partners, forming lines, and moving in time to the cheerful melody. Surely Einar would enjoy watching, even if he couldn't do the quick hopping steps that they all seemed to know. They could watch together. But when she looked back for him, it was too late. He had disappeared into the woods. Back to daily tasks after the excitement and holiday of the hand-fasting, tall Andrus knelt in the field and meticulously tied together the thick branches that would form the body of the mammoth. Then, after he had decided on a spot, in the center of the young sprouting crops, he pushed the main branch into the earth and patted the dirt firmly around its base so that it stood upright without tilting. He dressed it, carefully fitting the wide sleeves of a ragged coat over the two stick arms. He tied a sash around the middle to hold the coat closed, but loosely,
so that the breeze would lift and sway the fabric. He stood back and watched with satisfaction as the cloth moved. The ends of the arm branches extending from the sleeves looked like beckoning skeletal hands. Claire, approaching on her way to the stream, watched with a smile. She understood what he was doing, though she had never seen a Mammoth before. She stopped, watched, then called to Andras,
"Do you have a ribbon? If you added a long ribbon, it would wave in the wind."
He shook his head.
"I'll bring you one if you like," she suggested, coming closer.
He stood back and looked at his creation. "A ribbon would be good," he acknowledged, "around the neck." Claire laughed.
"The neck?" she asked.
There was only the gnarled branch end protruding upward from the patched coat. Andras laughed as well. "I'll make the head now," he told her, and showed her the large gourd waiting on the ground. He knelt beside it with his knife, carved a hole at one end. He dug out several inches of the pulpy flesh within, then placed the gourd atop the neck, fitting it down so that it sat firm. Claire could see that it looked indeed like a head, and that from a distance the entire Mammoth would seem a frightening, flapping creature. The crows would surely avoid it and the crops would be protected. He lifted the yellow gourd off the neck and set it on the ground again. "It needs a face," he told her. She sat on the soft earth and watched him begin to carve. First he gouged two circles near each other in the center of the gourd, then scraped at the rind between and below the eyes to create the impression of a nose. Impulsively, Claire tore some handfuls of grass from the earth and handed them to him.
"Hair," she said.
He laughed and draped the hair over the gourd. It slid away, and he looked around.
"Wait," he told her. "I can make it stay."
He left her with the gourd lying on the ground and went over to the edge of the woods. As she watched, he found the pine tree he had in mind and pulled a length of one supple branch loose.
"Oh, aye," he murmured. "This is good."
He brought it back to where she was sitting and showed her the wetness from the torn end where the bark glistened. He held it for her to sniff, the woodsy pine scent.
"Elise makes a pillow filled with the needles," she told him.
He nodded. He was smearing the oozing resin on the gourd.
"Aye, it soothes the sleep," he said. "Look now."
He picked up the torn grass and pasted it on the gourd's head, where it settled in tufty clumps, held tight by the sticky sap. They both laughed as he held it up.
"Some moment," Andra said with pride.
"Needs a mouth," Claire reminded him.
She pictured a grin on the odd creature.
"Aye, it does."
He bent over it, carving meticulously. She watched as he worked. Now and then he drew back, examined his own efforts, and then leaned forward to correct the shape, to trim the curves. She saw him smooth the mouth edges with his finger. He flicked away some tiny shreds of gourd.
"May I see?" she asked him.
"Wait."
He moved his blade to the expanse of yellow rind above the gouged eyes, and she could see him make three deep rippled cuts across the broad forehead. He looked at it and laughed in delight.
"There," he said.
He stood holding it and placed it carefully over the wooden neck, easing it down into place.
"There," he said again proudly, and turned with a grin to see her reaction.
Claire stared. The grotesque face stared back at her. Its forehead was wrinkled by the wide cuts which made it look puzzled, and the eyes squinted above the twisted nose. The mouth was a tortured smile, a leer. She caught her breath and felt her heart pound. Andras was laughing. She turned to him, horrified, not knowing why, and cheerfully he twisted his own face into a mimicry of the Mammoth. He thrust his tongue into his cheek, wrinkled his nose, and creased his forehead. He made a chortling sound. The skewed face, the laughter with it, made something flood into Claire's memory, surging upward in her like a wave about to break. She had made that face once and thought it funny. Someone had made it back to her. But why? Who? She pulled herself upward from the place where she had been sitting in the grass so cheerfully a moment before. She felt sick suddenly and began to cry.
"I'm sorry," she gasped. "I'm sorry. I'm sorry."
Then she turned and ran, sobbing and breathless, down the hillside, as Tall Andrus stood uncomprehending beside the wretched, ragged stick figure with its bulbous head. High above him, two crows wheeled in the sky and cried out. Elise had been busy sorting and separating her dried plants when Claire burst through the door, her face wet with tears, and threw herself onto the bed. It was clear that this was not a thwarted romance or a quarrel with a friend, the usual cause for the weeping of young girls. This was raw and deep. The old woman poured steaming water from the kettle over a few pinches of blue vervain and chamomile, then put the mug of herbal tea into Claire's hands. She watched with concern as the girl sat huddled and shaking in the dim light of the hut. "Something's come back then," Elise said. "Something cruel." Claire nodded. She took a few shuddering breaths and sipped the soothing drink. "It helps to say it," Elise suggested. Claire looked up at her.
"I can't," she said. "It was so close. It was there, so close. And I can feel it still, but I can't grasp what it is."
"What's brung it? Where be you when it comes so close?"
"Over on the hillside with Andrus, I was helping him build a stick figure to frighten the crows away."
"A marmot?"
"Yes, that's what he called it."
"Tall Andrus is a good lad. Surely it was nothing he done."
Claire hesitated.
"I don't think so. I can't remember exactly. We were laughing and then, well, everything changed. I can't think why."
"Something brung it. Want I should ask Andrus?"
Claire closed her hands around the mug and breathed the tea's steam.
"I don't know," she whispered after a moment. "I feel so sad."
Elise watched her and knew that the herbs in the mug would soothe the panic that had afflicted her, that soon she would calm and likely sleep for a bit. But they would not heal her. It would be hard to heal a girl as desperately wounded as this one. Chapter 6. The good weather days continued. The sun turned the wave tips to sparkling jewels, and the fishermen filled their nets each day with their glistening catch. In Tall Andrus's field, the marmot flapped its loose fabric arms, and the crows, made timid by it, called out harshly and went to other fields, other crops. The gourdhead began to rot in the sun and collapse upon itself, oozing and purple like a bruise. A bold starling swooped and grabbed some of the browning grass that had been its hair. One day it fell sideways into the field. When Claire walked past on her way to gather herbs, she saw only the toppled, ruined remains. The memory it had brought her was no longer there. Andrus's mother, Aelwyn, weakened and no longer left her bed. Elise tended her there, holding her head so that she could sip warm liquid made from chopped wild sunflower roots simmered in spring water. The medicine eased her cough, but it was a comfort, not a cure. "She'll not live," Elise told Claire. Claire had learned about death already in her time here, for they had buried an old fisherman earlier, and she had helped Elise wash and wrap the gaunt body before his sons lifted it into the box they had built. The fisherman's death had been sudden, though, in his sleep. Now Claire watched, day by day, as Aelwyn drifted in her mind, woke less often, and seemed to shrink. Finally, early one evening with Andrus and his father there, her breath slowed and stopped. The father and son touched her forehead gently as a goodbye and went away. Elise squeezed cloths that she lifted from the pail of water, handed one to Claire, and together they began to wash the thin body. Clean wrappings were folded nearby, waiting. "The day they brung you from the sea," the old woman said, "I washed you like this."
"Did you think I would die?"
Elise shook her head.
"I could see you were strong. You fought me some."
She chuckled softly as she patted Aelwyn's arm dry and laid it back gently on the bed.
"I don't remember."
"No, you wasn't yourself yet. It was your sleep self that fought me." Here?
She handed Claire a dry cloth, and together they dried and tidied the dead woman, folding her arms finally across her gaunt chest. Elise brushed her thin hair, and they carefully wrapped her.
They could hear the two men moving outside, readying the box.
They'll be needing a woman here, Elise said, glancing around the crude hut. The cooking vessels were unwashed and a blanket thrown across a chair was stained and in need of mending.
Yes, Claire agreed. Men don't tend houses well, do they?
Tall Andrus is of an age to wed, Elise said pointedly.
Claire shrugged. He should then.
It's you he wants.
Claire knew it to be true. She blushed.
I'm not of a mind to wed, she murmured.
Elise didn't hear, or pretended not to.
He'll want sons.
All men do, I expect. It was something Claire had observed in the village. Sons carried on the outside work. They took on the boats and the fields as their fathers grew old. Elise busied herself with tying the cords that held the wrappings firmly in place around Aelwyn's remains. Claire, silent now, helped her. She thought how proud Aelwyn must have once been to have birthed a strong boy like Andrus. They sat back. Their work was finished. In a moment they would call the men, father and son, to lift the woman into her coffin. The village would gather in the morning to place it in the earth.
On that day, the day I attended you, Elise said to Claire, I saw your wound.
Wound?
Your belly.
Claire placed her hand there protectively. She looked at the ground.
I don't,
she began, then faltered.
It's a grievous wound. Someone tended it, stitched it up. There are the marks.
I know, Claire whispered.
One day it will come back to your mind, like everything else.
Perhaps.
But I fear this, that you will not be able to give birth. I think it has been taken from you.
Claire was silent. Elise leaned forward and turned the flame higher in the oil lamp. It was darkening outside.
There are other ways a woman finds worth, she said in a firm, knowing voice.
Yes.
Come, we'll bring the men inside to be with her now.
They rose and went out into the evening where tall Andrus and his father waited in a light rain, their faces resigned.
In her mind, Claire made a list of what was new to her. Colors, of course. She was grateful for knowing them now. The red of holly berries and the red ribbon of the hand fasting. She marveled at the vibrancy and vigor of it, and she had come to feel bathed in contentment when the sky was blue, as it was on these late summer days. Sometimes the sea was quiet and blue as well, but most days it churned dark gray-green, with spumes of white blown and dissolved in the air. Claire liked that darkness as well, with its relentless motion and mystery, though she blamed the sea for hiding her past in its depths. Yellow she loved for its playfulness. Yellowwing, her little bird, came to her finger now when she poked it between the twigs that formed his cage. He hopped onto it and tilted his head at her with a questioning look. She wondered why she had ever been so frightened of birds. They were added to her list of newly learned things, birds and animals of all sorts. She still skirted the cow uneasily when she walked past, but she had become fond of lame Einar's sheep, especially the small ones, who frolicked in the tall meadow grass and showed their pink tongues when they bleated in excitement. Einar told her of wolves, but she had not seen one and did not want to, ever. She took joy in butterflies and scolded the little girls for catching them.
You've ruined it now, she said, looking sadly at the crumpled spotted wings in Bethan's outstretched hand. It deserved to live and to fly.
Together they buried the dead creature, but later she saw the child chasing another. She feared bees and most bugs.
You're like a wee child, Elise said to her, laughing when Claire backed